Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie. I'm Charlotte Metcalf and today I'm in conversation with Lynn Barber, one of the most multiple award-winning, respected and indeed formidable interviewers and writers of her generation. She's frequently nicknamed the Demon Barber in honour of her fearsome reputation, but I've interviewed Lynn before, so I'm delighted rather than apprehensive to be talking to her because I know her to be just as nice as she says she is. But I'll leave that to listeners to judge for themselves. Lynn, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't say I'm nicer. I never do. I wouldn't say that.
Well, let's start with your reputation, because you've always been very open about everything from how many fags you smoked, how many men you slept with, to how many bottles of wine you drink. Yeah. So I'm sure you don't mind me saying that you're now 80.
Yeah.
Are you a bit fed up with the whole demon barber nonsense, though?
Well, I was always quite puzzled by it, because you know, I only probably one in six interviews was a hatchet job, you know. But those were the ones people remembered. In fact, they were the ones people liked, and they were disappointed if I wasn't hatcheting somebody, you know. I was puzzled by it, though, because I'd been doing quite similar interviews for the Sunday Express magazine for years. And then when I went to the Independent on Sunday in 1990, suddenly I was sort of called a demon barber and hatchet woman and everything. I'm not quite sure why, actually. I think it was because I hatcheted one or two sort of popular people like
Felicity Kendall.
Yes. Mm. And Melvin Bragg and things.
Well, what did you say about him?
Well, I said that he was vain, which isn't difficult. I said that his latest novel at that time was staggeringly bad. You know, he's very variable. He's written some good novels and some very bad ones.
Everyone bangs on about what you said about Felicity Kendall, who was a bit of a sacred cow, wasn't she? Because she was such a pretty, perceived as such a pretty harmless little thing.
Yes.
And you said she had horrible hands.
I did. And actually, that's quite unusual for me, because I don't usually comment on physical attributes. But I thought that people confuse her with the character she played in The Good Life and think that she's really like that. And I don't think she is. I think she's really quite hard, you know.
Would you say you were ever deliberately spiteful?
No, no. Sometimes I think an editor sends me to interview somebody, hoping that I will take against them, you know, and then they're a bit disappointed if I don't. The one that really surprised people was I interviewed Lord and Lady Spencer. That was Rain Spencer, you
oh,
know.
Yes. And, with the hair.
Yes. And I found her charming, which was quite an unusual attitude at the time. What I really hate is if editors say, what's your angle on this? And until you've met someone, I don't think you should have an angle at all, actually. Just go and ask questions.
Who's the person who surprised you most?
Actually, it's an odd one. It won't mean much to people. Margaret Hodge. We got on like a house on fire. And yet she's the... I'm not sure what she is, the aunt or something, of Harriet Harman, who I really hatched it. Yes. And I thought she'd be like Harriet Harman. But she wasn't. She was really nice and good fun. I like interviewing artists because they're always good fun and they're always frank. And they're not trying to maintain an image or anything, which is what I find very tiresome about actors.
Talking of artists, you did not get on with the Chapman Brothers at all, did you? Just
no.
Remind our listeners what happened there.
Jason Dinos Chapman. Well, Jake, it was Jake particularly, but he just had a way of lecturing me, and he sort of said, and he kept saying, oh, you're so bourgeois. Of course I'm bourgeois, that, you know, of course, what are you? And anyway, and then I was interviewing both of them together, and I noticed that Dinos has something funny with his hand, like it's like a claw or something. And since they were making all this art about genetic mutations, it seemed completely legitimate to me to ask, you know, is your hand a genetic, were you born like that? And Jake went just through the roof, you know, how dare you ask him about something like that? And anyway, for years, he was so belligerent, and he said that they'd kill me if they ever saw me again. That if I saw them at a party, I'd sort of head the other way. But fairly recently, at a party of Tracy Emin in Margate, he came up to me and was as sweet as pie and said, "Hey, would I forgive him for how rude he was all those years ago?" And it's now a completely changed character, obviously. Actually, maybe I ought to re-interview them because... He sent me an email saying he no longer works with Tinos and actually didn't speak to him for a long time. I think they do now. But anyway, that was a good psychodrama, you know. I like an interview where, you know, something happened. You have a row or something like Marry Unfaithful.
Yes, tell our listeners about that because you really disliked her. I remember you and I talking about her before, and you really took against her. She was late. She was entitled.
Yes. She's rude to waiters and stuff like that.
Oh, the worst.
although I actually secretly did quite like her. Well, I just liked her uncompromisingness, you know. And she said at one point, "I'm not everybody's cup of tea," and I thought, "Yeah, that's right. That's fair." And I say that of myself as well. You know, if you like me, you like me. If you don't like me, you don't like me. That's okay. You know, and you can't. And the trouble with actors is that they have to try and make everyone like them, yes. And then they can't.
Remind our listeners what happened with Harriet Harman, because you didn't like her, but what made you ask her if she was thick?
Well, she just struck me as thick. That was one reason.
In what way?
She just didn't sort of pick up nuances, or she was very sort of plodding. And but I think that I can't now remember, but I think she'd said that somebody else had called her thick. And I sort of said, "Well, are you thick?" Oh, and then I said, "What university did you go to? And what did you read? And what degree did you get?" You know, so prove that you're a first-class brain. And she absolutely didn't. I thought she was sick, yeah.
Before we go back to an education and everything, I was really struck by the way you've talked about your father.
Yeah.
As you said, he was very rude and shouty. And that's made you completely unafraid.
Yeah.
Of people getting upset or cross.
Yes.
But I had a rude, shouty father.
Oh,
and it's had completely the opposite effect on me. I absolutely hate confrontation that might lead to that, because I had quite enough of it.
Really? Were you an angel?
No, but you were.
I was, and that was just my father-daughter relationship was, you know, argumentative, shouting, him saying, "No, you can't," and all this. And yet, I was really very fond of him. But that meant it was quite useful from the point of view of interviewing, because I think English, well, I say English, anyone really, if a conversation is getting difficult or near a row or near a confrontation, they sort of back off, yes, and calm it all down. Whereas as an interviewer, my instinct is always, come on, let's go for it, let's stoke the fire. You know, make something happen. Otherwise, it's just a polite conversation.
Do you think your father, though, that was his bark worse than his bite?
Well, it did hit me sometimes.
Did he?
Yeah. Well, he said a clip around the ear, but I mean, that is hitting. He was a very difficult man, you know. But because it was all I with you, Stu. I was very surprised when I met other people's fathers and found them so sort of nice.
How did your mother cope with him?
Well, she was sort of placatory and tried to stop us having rows. Or she would, after we'd had a big row, she'd come up to my room with a cup of tea and sort of say, oh dear, I'm sorry. And I'd say, look, Mum, you've got to divorce him. He's a monster. And then she'd slink off again. But she was slightly ostrich-like, you know. I mean, she kept out of it if possible.
So let's talk now about An Education. Mm. Famously turned into a screenplay by Nick Hornby.
Yeah.
And then Kerry Mulligan played the young Lynn Barber.
Yeah.
Just remind our listeners briefly about that story.
Well, it was originally an article I wrote for Granta about an affair I had when I was a schoolgirl. I was 16, with a much older man, and who eventually turned out to be married, and a con man. But my parents sort of, I think it was almost like grooming, you know. He got on terribly well with my parents. He'd bring flowers for my mother and sort of strange drinks for my father and all that shit. But I gradually, as I was going out with him, sort of kept noticing things that didn't add up. That he'd say he lived somewhere and then he said he lived somewhere else. And I was beginning to pick up that he was a crook. And then one weekend we went to stay with a friend in Cambridge and drove into the country. And do I call him Simon in the book?
Simon,
I think.
Yes, you do call him Simon.
Simon and his friend saw a cottage for sale and said, let's go round there. So we went to look at this cottage. And I saw Simon carrying something out to the car. And it turned out he'd stolen a speed map from this cottage. And the old lady must have been quite quick on the ball because we were picked up by the police very soon afterwards. And Simon was hauled off to the police station. And I got a train back to London. He was, you know, he's a bad lot. I split up with him when I found out he was married and went to Oxford, which was what I'd been meaning to do all along.
You found out he was married because you opened the glove compartment.
Yes, and that was a really weird thing because I was often in this car waiting for him while he went to visit a landlord or a manager of various flats, and he'd go around the flats to collect the rent, and I'd just wait in the car. And there always was this glove compartment, and it was just, eventually I opened it, and it was full of letters addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Simon, whatever.
Did you confront him there and then?
I did. Yeah, I did, actually. And then I told my parents. My father, next time he came to the house, my father went and tried to hit him, which was a rather touching sight, and kicked his car. Oh, no, that's right. I said, kick his car, Dad, that'll hurt him. Anyway, my parents were terribly upset about it.
Because he'd proposed to you, hadn't he,
at this point? And I had actually, you know, we looked at engagement rings and how, you know, properties to buy and his, although somehow, although I'd said yes, I don't think I ever really, really thought I was going to marry him, you know. But anyway, I found out that he was married in time to be able to still give up on all the idea of marrying him and go to Oxford, which was great, and I forgot about him immediately. But he came looking for me in Oxford.
Did he?
Yeah.
What did you do?
I lived in a convent run, just because my college had a convent run by nuns, and the nuns said this man came asking after you. And I said, well, don't ever let him in. He's a really evil man. But he left a note saying, I'm staying at the Randolph or whatever, come and have dinner. And I showed it to my then boyfriend and said, oh, look, this horrible old perv wants me to have dinner. And he said, oh, well, let's go. I'd love to meet him. So we went to meet him. And that was freaky because Simon sort of charmed Dick, who was my boyfriend. And I was sitting there sort of gnashing my teeth. but anyway, and actually for years afterwards, he used to phone. There was a date that he thought wrongly was my birthday. Like, my birthday is May 22nd and he thought it was May 24th, but there would always be a phone call from him on the day he thought was my birthday. And sometimes I'd pick up and shout at him a bit, and sometimes... I felt quite bitter towards him, really.
You never knew how old he was, did you? You thought never he was 27 when you were 16, but that was never verified, was it?
He said he was 27 when I was 16, but he was... No, he must have been older than that. And somebody worked out for me, because he'd mentioned various things about being in the Israeli youth army or certain events in Israel that a friend of mine was able to put dates on. So he wasn't that much older, but I mean, he was probably more like 37 than 27.
But he was really obsessed with you. I think you... Because he wanted you to run away to Israel. Marry, yes. And that he probably would really have done it, had you...
Oh, he really done it. Yeah. And then this was a great revelation from my mother. We never talked about him for year. And then right towards the end of their lives, my parents, who were then in their 90s, started opening up about him a bit. And apparently he'd asked my parents if they could, as it were, ship me out to Israel. Oh. So he could marry me.
Gosh. When was the last time you ever heard from him or saw him?
I know he's dead, because I had a quite creepy email from somebody claiming to be his son. And... and said, I believe you knew my late father.
Well, after that, I don't know how you famously said you slept with about 50 boys at Oxford, but not while you were living in the convent, I assume.
The point is, the convent was sort of just like a halls of residence. Yeah. It happened to be run by nuns. Yeah. But in fact, I had a boyfriend in Merton, so I was basically living in Merton. And actually, it wasn't that year when I was living in the convent. It was the next year when I went on the rampage. And that was just very odd, because I'd been going out with Dick all through the first year, was very devoted. Well, fairly devoted. and then when he dumped me, I went on this incredible sort of promiscuous splurge. And then... stopped. I mean, I started suddenly and stopped suddenly. And
did you stop because you met the great love of your life, David?
Yes. Well, no, because I'd stopped quite a long time before I actually met David. It was just in my second year.
And tell our listeners about David, because you said the minute you saw him, you just knew that was it. What was it that made you think that? Apart from the fact he was very handsome.
Yes, have a look.
Yes, I have studied Pixham. He's very handsome. I will vouch for that.
Yeah. He's very handsome. He had this very sort of dry sense of humour, very good sense of humour. He was interested in art, and although, which I was sort of willing to be interested, I mean, at that stage I wasn't, didn't know anything about art, but I was very happy to go to museums and galleries with him and learn about art through him. He was very complimentary to me. I was always the one who had to negotiate with the plumber or something. Do you know what I mean? I was a business brain. But the other great thing about David, and you know why I'm forever grateful, is that he said, if we marry, we will have a family. And also said, if you find you don't like, you know, looking after them, I'll give up work and look after them and you can go back to work. So it was a very, very good basis for marriage. And of course, I'm now hugely grateful that I did have John. But if I'd fallen for somebody who was sort of iffy, like lots of men are now, aren't they?
I just think it's so interesting that you had such a, until he very sadly died during a bone marrow transplant, aged only 59, you had, what you had of him was so happy and functional and lovely, and you famously said he made you a gooder person.
Absolutely.
Which I thought was adorable.
Yes.
So you are nice, really.
but
he, it's so interesting because the Simon thing and your background with his charity father, and yet you ended up in a very
good relationship.
Yes.
And actually, that's one reason why I mentioned the promiscuity, because something you were always told in my generation was, if you sleep around, you'll never make a good marriage. And I would say, well, I slept around, here's my good marriage, you know. So,
and I've heard you be interviewed several times and heard the slightly, not judgmental tones of people listening to you, but there is still a little bit of a sort of harumphing that goes on, isn't there, when you're very honest.
I can't understand why people aren't honest, actually. It just seems to me that being honest makes life easier, doesn't it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, one of the reasons you're a brilliant interviewer is you are not going to take, if you smell any dishonesty there, you'll go on probing around until you get it. Who's the last person you interviewed?
Tammy Badnock for the Mail on Sunday, for You magazine, and didn't really get much out of her, but I was terribly impressed but sort of daunted, you know. I sort of felt that she was a superior class of person.
Expand. What? In what way?
Well, she's terribly sure of herself and very, very good talker, you know, speaks very fluently, and just, she's sort of thought things through and sorted them out. And she doesn't sort of wobble and waver like I do. So she's dead impressive. But also, she made this famous remark, not to me, but lunch is for wimps. And I thought, oh, lunch is my favourite activity. And I'm a wimp. And I am a wimp. She, you know, she's one of these people who works 24 hours a day.
But did you like her?
No, not really. But I mean, just that I didn't sort of warm to her. It's not, and I couldn't imagine if we were sort of stuck on a long plane journey together, what we'd talk about, really. Because she is, you know, she's passionately interested in politics, and I'm not. And she's more serious minded than I am. And so, we just didn't have anything in common, really.
Would I be right in saying she's one of the youngest people you've interviewed? Because I read somewhere you want to interview more young people. You interviewed Dominic Cummings at one point, didn't you?
Yeah.
What did you make of him?
Oh, I loved him. I still do. And his wife, Mary Wakefield. It was just that it got to a stage where I was being offered a lot of old people on the basis that I was old, and actually I found it more stimulating to interview young people, and probably still do, actually, just because they're, you know, I want to know what they think. I can't interview really young people because I can't understand what they're talking about.
Who would you like to interview who's young?
I wouldn't minding Ed Sheeran.
What do you think is interesting about Ed Sheeran?
Well, he's very engaging and likeable, and he's a big deal down in Suffolk near Framlingham, where a friend of mine, Sarah Lucas, lives near there. And apparently he's one of these really, you know, good people who sort of donates a lot of money to local causes and all that stuff. Mm.
And the other person that you'd do you still want to interview Rupert Murdoch?
Oh, yes, I'd love to interview Rupert Murdoch. Yeah, but I don't think I ever will.
Have you tried?
Oh, God, yes, I've tried. All sorts of... for years, you know. And actually, Dominic Cummings said he'd get me Rupert Murdoch, but he didn't. But, I mean, I'd also sort of slightly think, why would Rupert Murdoch waste his time doing interviews? You know, he's not got anything to sell or to... he's not got the sort of vanity or anything that he could only lose, I think, by doing it.
Of course, you said somewhere that a monster is always much more interesting than...
oh, yes, a nice person, yes.
Do you think most people have a inner monster?
No, I don't, actually. Oh. I think... this is a particular sort of sweet person, usually a woman, that I'm quite suspicious of. I mean, I always think, she probably goes and sticks pins in a wax doll or something. But no, I mean, I think most people don't have inner monsters. Do you think they do?
I think anger is something a lot of us repress enormously,
yes.
And that comes out in all sorts of,
yes,
weird, rather nasty ways.
It's interesting that Twitter has sort of unleashed,
yes,
anger, hasn't it?
Mm.
And that probably lots of those people writing vicious tweets are as meek and mild as anything. If you... what was it? I first encountered a sort of Twitter storm when I was rude about Rafa Nadal, the tennis player.
Oh, you talked about him fiddling with his shorts or something.
Yes, and... and suddenly got sort of 600 tweets overnight, almost all saying, I hope you get cancer. You know, there used to be this thing of people who wrote poison pen letters.
Yes.
And it's probably that, isn't it? They're hiding behind anonymity. They sort of vent their malice.
I was very viciously trolled once, and it was really horrible, because they talked about killing my daughter, who was then seven, which I thought was really...
oh, no.
I think that's what... drove me away. If it had just been about me, I might have been braver, I think.
Yes. Mm. You can always just not read them. That's always...
yes,
horrible.
Quite. Quite, yes.
But...
yes. So you've got... Have you got grandchildren now?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes. How many grandchildren do you have?
I've got two daughters with two children each, so four grandchildren. And they're just getting... the eldest now is 16 and wants to come and stay here to go to pop concerts or parties in London.
Oh, what fun.
They all live in Brighton. It's a great range of characters. Three grandsons and one granddaughter, and they're all different and interesting, and I like it.
What do your daughters do? Did either of them follow in your footsteps?
No, not at all. Yeah, no, they both went in a sort of business or science way rather than writing.
How interesting. Did you read English at Oxford?
Mm.
And then you worked at Penthouse.
For
you?
Years and years.
Yes.
7 years. I was never asked to pose, but I was in charge of all the literary stuff and the word side of things. And it was great. I mean, it was a great magazine training in a way.
How did you get that job?
Because Bob Guccione, who started Penthouse... mm-hmm. While I was still at Oxford, he'd launched Penthouse, and one of the things he'd done was to send a flyer to all the Oxford dons, or lots of posh heads of colleges or something, and they all professed themselves sort of really shocked and horrified to receive this filth in the face. So I went to London to interview him. And we got on very well. He said, any time you want a job, honey, come to me. And so I did. It was good.
Yeah, but who did you interview him for?
At Tarwell, the university,
yes,
paper.
Yeah. So were you doing a lot for Tarwell? Did you end up being its editor?
Not a lot, but I did do bits and pieces. And I... and for ISIS, and I didn't do much journalism at Oxford, but before, when I was still at school, I'd written a children's column for the Richmond Oakland Times. Mm. So I was very clued up to the idea that I could make money by writing, and so always thought that that's what I would do.
Mm. And who did you interviewed Salvador Dali when you were 25, didn't you?
Yes.
Who was that for?
That was for Penthouse. And that was because Bob Guccione, he admired Salvador Dali much more than I did, actually. And he said that he would be interviewed when he was staying in Paris at the Hotel Maurice, and I'd got to fly to Paris. And oh, that was just fabulous, you know. I only had a day return flight, but Dali liked me and said, oh, you've got to stay, and got me a room at the hotel.
Oh, how fabulous.
That was great.
And what was he like?
Guccione said, I've got to ask him about sex. So, of course, we talked about sex. And he would say, oh, his great thing is the masturbation. All the great artists are great masturbators. None of them have children, which is wrong, you know. But anyway, so, I don't know, he just found it amusing being interviewed by me, I think. And told me to stay, and I stayed for 3 days. It was good.
Would you say that was the one of the most interesting people you'd interviewed?
No, I mean, the sort of haunting one for me was Rudolf Nureyev. And I often think, and what's so weird about that interview was that I think he was actually trying to tell me that he was dying
from AIDS. Mm.
And I was somehow just not putting out any hints of it, or I don't know why, it's so strange. And I mean, it was in a period where if you knew that someone was gay, you wondered if they had AIDS, you know. It wasn't a far-fetched thought.
And how long after that did he die?
Oh, quite a long time after that, but I mean, he, because he's still dancing, although he's 50-something. But I don't think they didn't actually sort of say he had AIDS until he died, did they? I don't think.
Two more things I want to ask you about. One is the people who make you laugh most. You said Michael Winner always made you laugh.
Oh, yes, he did. I mean, I rather shudder to think of it, but yeah, he did. He was so funny and so badly behaved.
Have you interviewed many comedians?
Yeah, no, I haven't done that many. But one of the problems with interviewing is if people embark on anecdotes. The one I wrote a very funny piece about was Kirk Douglas, that was years ago, but he just has one anecdote after another, and you sort of try and cut in and try and ask a question, but he just sort of says that. It's like you're holding up cue cards and he's saying, oh, she mentioned golf, I'll tell her this anecdote or that anecdote. And they're really not worth it.
When you sit down with somebody to interview them, do you know in the first sort of 15 seconds if you're going to like them or not like them? Do you have a strong instinct?
No, I would say not as quickly as that, no.
Have you ever started off in one place and done a complete 360 turn as a result of probing around?
Yes. Oh, the one where there was a real turn was Joseph Heller, Catch
22. Yes.
You know, I hugely admired the book, hugely thought I'd like him. And he was such a nasty, weirdo, horrible, creepy man.
And when you discover that you really don't like somebody, is that quite a dismaying feeling, or is part of you thinking, oh, this is going to make really good copy?
Well, if it's a real flat-out Marianne Faithfull or something, I think, oh, hooray, you know, I'll go to town on this. The hard ones are where I sort of quite like somebody, but I suppose in a way, like Temi Badenoch, where I sort of admire them, she ticks lots of boxes, But I wouldn't want to spend any time with her, really.
Because you have become friends with people you've interviewed, haven't you?
Well, not many, but Tracy Emmons, she's a big one. The first time I met her was when I interviewed her, and that was 24 years ago. We've been friends ever since. And we just hit it off immediately. It was really odd. I like her art. I like her attitude to life. I like her courage, you know, incredible courage. And never self-pitying.
Not
once, you know. I suppose she's a really outstanding human being, in my view. And I often wonder why she likes me, but I think it's because I'm frank with her.
So, Lynn, what else are you doing at the moment?
Well, I'm still doing odd book festivals and things for my book, A Little Art Education, which is about my friendships with various artists. And I'm doing the Hay Festival, that'll be good. But whether I could write another book, I don't know. I can't. No subject springs to mind.
This was published on your 80th birthday.
Yes.
Yes. So tell our listeners who's in it.
Tracy Emin, Sarah Lucas, Jason Dinos Chapman, David Hockney, Salvador Dali, who I interviewed early.
What was David Hockney like?
Oh, I've interviewed him a lot. He's lovely.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's a very beautiful book as well.
It's
pink and illustrated and just generally a very nice possession.
It feels nice. Called A Little Art Education.
And
Cheerio Publishing.
By Cheerio.
Price £15.
And I hope we have another book from you soon.
Oh, well. Maybe.
Maybe a book on your favourite monsters.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, that might be good.
So what now?
Pottering along, getting lazier and lazier, I think is the answer. I've always said to the girls that I'll move to Brighton when I retire.
And will you?
Well, no, this is the point. I've become... Well, that's one of the reasons why I sort of persist in doing bits of journalism that I don't, you know, I don't financially need to, but just that I like to say, oh, I haven't retired yet.
So do you plan to stay in London then? Do you love London?
Well, I love London and I love being in London. And I love this house. But I can see that, you know, as I get older and older, there's certain things I can't do. Like, I can't do the Royal Academy summer. I can't walk far enough to walk right round an exhibition, you know. So my options are getting smaller. When you're as old as me, your friends are dying off, sort of one by one. So when I don't have that many friends in London, I probably will move down to Brighton. Although by then, actually, the grandchildren will probably be very insistent that they have a house in London.
I bet they'll all be here.
Yeah, it's a lovely big house near the Tube in Archway. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, Lynn, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. What a delight to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Lynn Barber. If you've enjoyed listening to us, go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll find plenty more conversations like this and where you can also subscribe to the magazine. Thank you so much again to you, Lynn Barber, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.